We are now only a few weeks out from the biggest and best conservative women's event in the nation, Turning Point USA's Young Women's Leadership Summit. This is an all-ages, two-day female event, June 7th through 9th in San Antonio, Texas, where you will make like-minded friends, you'll be able to network, you'll be introduced to fun conservative companies in the exhibit hall, plus hear from the biggest names changing culture, Megyn Kelly, House and Habits, Jessica Krause, Dr. Jolene Brighton, Emma's for Mama, Suzanne Venker, Holistic Hilda, Erica Komazar, Riley Gaines, Candace Owens, Ali Stuckey, Heidi St. John, Francis Winslow, Katie Faust, and many more. If you have a baby, don't worry, there's going to be a mother's room for you. If you don't know anyone, don't worry. Over 65% of attendees this year have never been before. Everyone is looking to make new friends. Get all the info at YWLS2024.com. Reserve your ticket now before we sell out. You can get 25% off general admission with code Alex. YWLS2024.com with code Alex for 25% off. Let's get back to our roots in San Antonio, Texas, June 7th through 9th. Find the link anytime in the show notes. There are 50 million 20-somethings that deserve to know what psychologists, sociologists, neurologists, and fertility specialists already know, that realizing the importance and significance of life decisions you make in your 20s is one of the simplest yet most transformative things that you can do for work, for love, for your happiness, maybe even for the world. This is what my guest, a clinical psychologist who specializes in working with young adults, believes. She is issuing an alarm that telling young people 30 is the new 20 is completely counterproductive and really setting them up for failure in all aspects of life, not success. In this provocative talk, my guest says that just because marriage, work, and kids are happening later in life doesn't mean that you shouldn't start planning now. You'll hear up-to-date research on work, love, the brain, friendship technology, and fertility. She is the international best-selling author of The Defining Decade and her latest book, The 20-something Treatment. Her TED Talk, Why 30 is Not the New 20, has been viewed more than 10 million times. Watch this interview on the Real Alex Clark YouTube channel and subscribe for more content from me, like weekly live shows, daily YouTube shorts, vlogs, and more. If you love the conversations that we're starting on this show, please consider being a financial supporter and making a tax-deductible donation with the link in the show notes. Our ability to produce and edit this show is only possible with donations from listeners like you. Please welcome author and clinical psychologist, Dr. Meg Jay, to The Spillover. Dr. J, what is it about our 20s that convinced you this is the decade that clinical psychologists need to be talking more about?
I work with 20-somethings, Alex, because this is really where all the action is. It's a developmental sweet spot. It's really what I call the critical period of adult development. There's more happening in your 20s in terms of life's most defining moments than is going to happen at any time thereafter.
Yeah, you say that the 20s are a developmental sweet spot. And I've been talking a lot about the first 3 years of a child's life being a developmental sweet spot with attachment and building that relationship between child and mother. But I didn't know that there was also a period for this happening in our 20s.
Yeah, so the 20s are really the critical period of adult development. That the metaphor that I use is working with 20-somethings. It's like working with planes just after takeoff. A slight change in course can have a big impact on where people land. So a few factoids for you. I think maybe I just mentioned it. 80% of life's most defining moments take place by the age 35. Your learning curve in terms of career predicts your earning curve in your 30s and beyond. More than 50% of Americans meet their partner in their 20s. Our fertility starts to peak in our 20s. Our personality changes in our 20s more than any other time in life. And the brain is changing too. So all those factors work together to really set the foundation for who we're going to be in adulthood.
What are the types of conversations that adults are not having with young people while they're graduating from high school and getting ready to transition into their 20s, going into college, that we really should be having?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of 20-somethings are rightly stressed and anxious. And rather than just reassuring them and saying, oh, you're fine, you have all the time in the world. First of all, that's not true. Second of all, 20-somethings don't find that to be helpful. Just platitudes and reassurance is not helpful. What they actually find helpful is for somebody to say, oh, well, I'm taking your concerns seriously. I'm taking your stressors and your anxieties about, will my life work out? I'm taking it seriously. So you want to ask someone, what are you worried about? How do we prevent that from happening? What are your hopes and dreams for 5 or 10 years down the line? And how can we help you get there starting now?
What are the answers that you're typically given when you ask that question? What are you worried about in your early 20s?
I'm worried no one will ever love me. I'm worried I'll never be able to pay my bills. I'm worried my career won't work out. I'm worried I'll be unhappy. That 20-somethings tend to sort of skew negative, that there's a lot of uncertainty in the 20s, and how the brain reacts to uncertainty is to sort of catastrophize and imagine the worst. So a lot of what I do with 20-somethings is help them, you know, calm down and try to replace fears with facts and start to think about, well, if we can find out what you're afraid of, we can find out what it is you actually hope will happen, what you want, and how we start to put those, you know, dreams on a deadline, how we start to have goals.
Have those fears and negative feelings gotten worse in recent years compared to when you first started working with this age group?
You know, people have been asking me that a lot recently. So I've been specializing in 20-somethings for 25 years, believe it or not, my whole career. And so lately, everybody's saying, why is it so much worse now? And what's interesting is I've been specializing in this age group for 25 years because, like you said, that is the developmental sweet spot. It's also a mental health low point. It's been a mental health low point for the last 25 years, which is why as a clinical psychologist, I work there. It's a tough time. I think now we're talking about mental health more, which is kind of great, but I think a conversation that was supposed to be about mental health has sort of too quickly become about mental illness. And so unfortunately, a lot of 20-somethings are struggling and they say, oh no, I must have a mental health disorder. I must need medication, when often neither of those things are true.
You say that your 20s are likely not going to be the best years of somebody's life, but that that's actually good news and not bad news. Could you elaborate on that?
Too many 20-somethings here. These are going to be the best years of your life. So they're very disappointed and even alarmed when they find out an experience that they're not, that they're actually quite challenging. So I really normalize the fact that it's common, it's expectable to struggle a lot in your 20s. You're trying to figure out work and love and where you're going to live and who you're going to be and who your friends are. That's a lot. It's hard. And so I try to normalize the struggle and say, hey, these probably aren't going to be the best years of your life, but you don't want that. If your 20s turn out to be the best years of your life, something has gone terribly wrong. As a client said to me once, don't peak in your 20s, that life really should get better as you go. And I think it helps 20-somethings to learn that life actually does get better as you go. If you look at the data, mental health gets better, life satisfaction, purpose and meaning, relationships, finances, everything gets better across your 30s and 40s and 50s, especially if you put the work in your 20s.
And I think that adults really try to help when they talk to young people and tell them, oh my gosh, your 20s, you have your whole life to figure everything out. You really don't have to think about life starting until you're even 30. You have so much time. But is that hurting more than helping?
Absolutely, because that's not entirely true. I tell 20-somethings, you don't have to have everything figured out by age 30. I think there's some panic of what if I don't have it all done by I'm 30. You don't have to have everything figured out by age 30, but 30 is not a great time to start everything. That 20s is really when you need to start experimenting with work and love and cities and life and, you know, how you want things to go for yourself. That when we tell people they have infinite time, that really takes away people's urgency and ambition. And they think, well, you know, why do I need to start today?
You know, I am the biggest book girly to ever live. Cue Taylor Swift's I Hate It Here. If you know, you know. A fantastic book recommendation that I had to share because it just perfectly goes with the theme of this episode is You're Not Alone, The Conservative Woman's Guide to College. It's an Amazon bestseller written by Karen A. Lips, the founder and president of the Network of Enlightened Women, or NEW for short. And if you don't know, NEW is the nation's premier organization for conservative university women. women. I know you know that female conservative students today face silencing pressure from their peers, hostile liberal professors, biased administrators, and more. Karen A. Lipps wrote You're Not Alone, The Conservative Woman's Guide to College, to prepare young women for what they will encounter on college campuses. This is a fantastic high school graduation gift. It is the only college guide designed explicitly for conservative college women. Karen identifies problems on campus and provides practical tips on how conservative young women can thrive in this environment. You will also hear stories and advice from real-life conservative college women. In the Amazon bestselling You're Not Alone, The Conservative Woman's Guide to College, you'll discover chapters that focus on topics like picking a college major, running for student government, building a community, dating in college as a conservative, and more. This is an essential guide that conservative college women can turn to when they have questions about handling specific situations on college campuses. Buy it for your daughters, yourself, or conservative graduates in your life that are going to need some encouragement. Code ALEX will get you 20% off your copy at enlightenedwomen.org. That's code ALEX for 20% off your copy at enlightenedwomen.org. Find the link and the code in the show notes. When it comes to talking to high school graduates about the college conversation, what are some different messages that we're giving them that's actually setting them up for failure? And that could be in terms of anything. I mean, it could be going into debt for student loans. It could be choosing your major. We give bad advice around that.
Yeah, actually, it's interesting you ask that. I'm thinking about having my next book be specifically about college because I've lived in college towns. I've been, you know, affiliated with the university my whole life. And I have a lot to say about college, so maybe we'll do that on another podcast. But my basic thoughts are that, unfortunately, not enough colleges give students basic good starting advice. So I'll give you two or three really great starting college tips. They might sound obvious, but you would be shocked at how many college students aren't doing these. The first is go to all your classes. That might sound like really basic, but I'm sorry to tell you, parents who may be listening, most college students aren't doing that. And so that in and of itself creates a lot of anxiety around, oh no, I don't know what's happening. I'm behind. I'm cramming at the last minute. So for a lot of college students, it's really about going back to basics. Don't think about who you want to be forever, what you're trying to do forever. Really just think about what do I need to do to sort of learn in college the skills I need to do well in my 20s and beyond. So that means showing up for classes. That means preparing. That means, you know, maybe getting some sleep. That means learning how to make friends, learning how to handle problems, learning how to ask for help. So I think in college, we can learn a lot of the skills that we need for the 20s. But college is also a time when you can really get by on, you know, life's worst habits.
Are you seeing more young people opting to skip the college experience entirely?
I think that's going to be a really interesting question across the next 5 years or so. I definitely see more people talking about that. Now, I work at a university, so I'm not seeing the people who aren't coming. But I think more and more parents are talking about that. I think it's going to take a leap of faith for them to say, oh, well, you know, we're just not going to do that. I think there needs to be a what else? Well, what are the real viable alternatives to college? Or is it a vocational school? Is it a certificate program? Is it community college? But I do see more and more parents starting to question, is all the money worth it?
Are college graduates today graduating feeling like, okay, this money was well spent, it was worth it, it has set me up for success? Or a lot of them coming to you going, Dr. J, I feel like I have just wasted 4 years of my life and so much money.
Well, that's definitely the fear, I think, not just for college graduates, but even more for their parents, because they're often the ones who are paying for it. And I definitely try to prevent that. And I think one way to prevent that is to feel like that when you're in college, you know how to engage with that experience. You know, it's often not just about specifically your major. It's often not where you go to college or either whether you go to college, but how you go to college. So how are you doing those 4 years? Do you have skills that translate to the workplace? And I think a lot of students feel like they don't.
What are some of the biggest financial mistakes that people are making in their 20s?
I mean, I'm not a financial advisor, but I think we could all probably look at credit card debt and go, oh, gosh, please don't. So I think credit card debt, you really have to be careful of. And of course, the young adult brain is very sort of here and now focused and has a hard time kind of imagining, you know, how things add up. And I'm not just talking about money, but even choices and consequences, how those add up across 5 or 10 years. So it's pretty easy for young adults to get into some pretty gnarly credit card debt. And so I think helping people think more about how their choices right now, not even just about credit cards, but also about dating or about those jobs or about, you know, other aspects of their lives, how those are going to like literally add up in 30 days or in 2 years.
What is the big misconception about social anxiety?
Yeah, social anxiety is an interesting one. So right now, my latest book is called The 20-Something Treatment. It's exclusively about young adult mental health. Social anxiety is the fastest rising diagnosis among young adults. Now, I say diagnosis because that doesn't mean that they have social anxiety disorder. It just means that's the thing they're most likely to be diagnosed with. The reason for this is it's shockingly easy to be diagnosed with social anxiety disorder as a young adult because the criteria are, I worry too much about what other people think about me. I'm worried about being judged negatively. I worry about, you know, speaking in public places or in social situations. I mean, that might be somewhat unusual for a 45-year-old, but for a 25-year-old, that is absolutely par for the course. So actually about 50% of 20-somethings meet criteria for social anxiety disorder, which mean the criteria are wrong for 20-somethings that we need to sort of, when you look at that in developmental context, we need to realize half of 20-somethings are not disordered. It's just very normal to feel socially uncertain. So when a young adult comes to me and they say, oh, I have social anxiety disorder, I saw the criteria online, I saw a video on TikTok, I have it, then I, you know, educate them about what I just told you. And I ask them to think about it more like social uncertainty, that it's normal to be uncertain about how to give a presentation at work or how to make small talk at a party or, you know, whether someone's going to text you back or whether your boss is going to be mad at you about something. This is normal for 20-somethings, and it doesn't help them socially to then, on top of the social uncertainty, to feel like, oh, there's something wrong with me. Great, I have a disorder.
Is it true that half of young adults do not have someone they would consider a best friend or even a close friend?
That's what the data say. And I do see that a lot among young adults. And it's not because they're socially incompetent. I think it really has to do with more with that transient period of time that so many 20-somethings are leaving college. They're in new places. They're trying to find new jobs. They're trying to start lives. Or maybe they did have a best friend, but now the best friend has a boyfriend or got married. And so they're not hanging out anymore. So, you know, I think friends are really coming and going a lot for 20-somethings. They're changing all the time. So I think that's often more about that. But it's really a time of life where you're going to need friends. Your 20s, believe it or not, are actually the loneliest time of life. And that's because you spend a good 10 years between families, that you're not waking up with a household of people who hopefully love you and that you're happy to see every day. You're waking up alone in an apartment or with roommates, you know, you may or may not get on with. And so it's a time where you really need friends, but it's also a time where friends really come and go.
For those people who are in their 20s struggling, feeling like I just can't make good friends, what is your advice for how to make friends as a young adult?
Yeah, I mean, my best advice is go live your life, leave your apartment and go about your day. That if all the data show, and of course, common sense will tell us the same, as well as life experience, that you're going to meet your friends. You're going to find like-minded people who have the same values, passions, pursuits, hobbies, interests. If you go about your day and you go to work or you do your hobbies, you join in on activities, you kind of take part in life around you. That's how you do it. I think it seems a little confusing to 20-somethings of like, why is it so much work all of a sudden? Because all growing up in school, you just look around yourself and you're in a classroom of 30 to 300 people who are already probably a lot like you, same age, similar interests, etc. But then you go into the adult world, suddenly you're dropped into a city and those people aren't sitting around you all day, every day. You have to figure out how to make friends. And those of us out there who are older than 20s. I mean, we know you have to do that again and again. You might move to a new city mid-career or find yourself amongst a new group when you have kids and you have to make friends with new moms. So it's really a skill that you need throughout life, but one that's new to 20-somethings because they're used to being in school where it's pretty darn easy to make friends.
Do you ever deal with clients who are like the last single friend in their 20s and all of their friends are married now and starting to have kids and they're feeling left out and lonely and like they have nothing in common with their close friends anymore and so that's why they're starting over with friends?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know, rarely like the very last, but I see it all the time that someone's very best friend now has a boyfriend and suddenly they're not as available as they used to be. And so they realize like, wow, life is going to change, that the people who used to be my go-tos on a Friday or a Saturday or a weekend. And, you know, I see this also with families, that siblings grow up and now they're married and they have families, and that so young adults are often go, wait a minute, what happened to my friends and my family? But what happened is they're growing up and they're, you know, creating new friends and families of their own, which means you probably need to do the same.
I'll never forget getting this humongous package 3 years ago shipped to my office. I opened it up. There's this fancy bottle of red wine, a crap ton of skincare, and a note. And I had never heard of this company before. They were like, hey, Alex, no pressure at all. We're this new conservative and Christian-owned skincare company. We love the work that you do and just wanted to send some of our line to you so you can try it and we can get your feedback. We're really looking for honest feedback on our products. Feel free to post if you want, but it's definitely not required. Hope you enjoy. Of course, I was excited about the wine, hello. But also, just to be honest with you, I mean, with how dry and temperamental my skin is, I just did not think for a second that anything that this new company sent over for me was going to work for me. I tried their hydrating cream. Oh my gosh. It is like I took my first ever drink of water, the best moisturizer I've ever used. I wrote them an email immediately asking for more, begging them to let me talk about them on my shows and social media. And years later, I'm still sending DMs asking for more of that moisturizer, and my skin suffers so badly when I go without. See what the hype is about by trying Nimi Skincare, and literally see what the hype is about by looking me up on Real Alex Clark YouTube. What does my skin look like to you? I mean, it speaks for itself. Modern skincare with timeless values. Go to NimiSkincare.com. Use code AlexClark for 10% off. That's NimiSkincare.com with code AlexClark for 10% off. And that link is in the description. Do you have any theories as to why so many young people feel like they don't know how to make friends without a therapist's help?
Like I said, it's new that their whole life, this has been something that was just so easy that people didn't think much about it, that, you know, you make friends with the person sitting in the desk next to you or who's on your hall in your dorm or, you know, who you used to ride bikes with in your neighborhood. So, you know, for the 20 years you've been living on the planet, making friends has been pretty easy. And whatever effort it was required, your parents were probably doing it for you. So creating the play dates and booking birthday parties. And then suddenly in your 20s, it's like, wait a minute, none of that is ready made. I do not think people need a therapist to make friends.
Well, I asked that because I talked to Abigail Schreier about her new book, Bad Therapy. And that was something she said, is that she has seen there's this explosion of like teenagers and young adults who are going into college and they're saying, my therapist, what are you going to therapy for? Well, my therapist is teaching me how to make friends in college. And so her theory is that it has something to do with the parenting, how millennials and even Gen X have been parenting kids. And then that's why we're seeing this explosion of kids that are like totally helpless in the real world when it comes to making friends. And so I didn't know if you had the same experience.
What I see more is that it's really the first time that people are going, wait a minute, I have to make friends, you know, out of a city versus out of a classroom or out of a dorm. But I definitely do not think that 20-somethings need a therapist to make friends, that it's, you know, it's an adult skill. And just this podcast is probably enough, or there's plenty of articles in the newspaper. And, you know, often just the normalizing that, yeah, it's tough. It's a lonely time of life. I think a lot of young adults have responded, you know, to me, I get messages about, oh, that was so helpful to hear that the 20s can be really lonely because I thought I was doing something wrong and that everybody had friends and that I don't have friends. But really, I think it's a tough time because everyone's going in different directions and so much is changing.
What about people that need to break up with a friend? What is the best way to go through a toxic friend breakup?
Well, I mean, that's another skill that people are learning a lot in their 20s, how to have those difficult conversations. So, you know, I guess it depends on how toxic the relationship is. If it's just a relationship that needs to change or go separate ways, I think it's really great if you can let the person know that, hey, I care about you. We've had a great friendship, but it's just not a fit for me anymore. That would be fantastic. If the relationship is really toxic, sometimes you just need to remove yourself and let your actions speak for themselves. So I think it depends on maybe what you're going to get in return in that conversation.
What does it mean to gain identity capital?
Yeah, so identity capital is really what I tell 20-somethings their job in terms of work is in their 20s is go get as much identity capital as you can. I think for many years, maybe even decades, the sort of the theory was, oh, you need to have an identity crisis. You know, you need to sort of not know what you're going to do and wander around and somehow you're going to figure that out by thinking. We really know that young adults don't figure a lot out by sitting there and thinking. They figure out who they want to be or what they want to do or what's going to work for them professionally by going out there and doing things. So too often, I think young adults imagine that they need to know in their 20s, what am I going to be for the rest of my life? Before I take this job, I need to know how everything's going to turn out. When actually, on average, 20-somethings will have 9 different jobs by the age of 35, and most of them end up doing things they'd never even heard of or that maybe didn't exist when they were in college. So this idea that you can ask a college student, you know, what do you want to be for the rest of your life? And you've got to figure that out before you start doing something makes no sense. So I tell them, listen, just go out there and earn identity capital. So identity capital are really just the skills that we acquire, the things that we do that add value to ourselves. It shows people, you know, what have I done with my time? How have I invested in myself? And so you might be at a job for 1 year, 2 years, learn a lot about how to be a worker, about that specific field. You might go further in that one and then pivot to another one. But you take that identity capital with you wherever you go, which is what's really wonderful about it, is that once you gain skills, no one can take those away from you.
What are the weak ties in your friend group and how are they critical to success in life?
Weak ties are critical to success in life, and they're not just in your friend group. Weak ties are anyone you've ever met and everyone they've ever met. So your strong ties are really sort of your best friends and family. Your weak ties are all the other people that you, like I said, have ever met and everybody that they know or even are weakly connected to. And the important thing about weak ties is that I tell 20-somethings, your strong ties are your most supportive figures in your network. They're the ones who are going to bring you soup when you're sick or take you to the airport. Your weak ties are the most transformative figures. And that's because they're not your best friends and family. They have different lives, different perspectives, different experiences, different pasts. So they have access to information and opportunities that your best friends don't, or if they have, whatever your best friends know, you've already heard it by now. So weak ties are almost always where the new apartments come from, the new job ideas, the new people to date.
Is that where meeting your spouse usually comes in, is from weak ties?
Well, I mean, I think these days I'd have to look at the data. I want to say it may be about 50% online, you know, internet dating. And then the other 50%, I think often does come through friends of friends or, you know, different weak ties. So, you know, but it isn't even just partners. It's also new apartments, new ideas about jobs. Actually, that weak tie data came from a study that was done in Stanford now many years ago. But what they found was that the majority of people who had found a new job got the lead through just an acquaintance, but not through a close family or friend. And so that really helped that person sort of hatch that theory called the strength of weak ties, which is about if you want to figure out something new or find something new or meet someone new, you've got to cast a wider net than your friends and family.
A lot of Facebook groups, I think, are like a perfect example of that. You know, niche interests or your state or your city. And then, you know, reaching out to those people who, I mean, couldn't that be considered like a weak tie? Like you comment back and forth on each other's posts in some Facebook group. You don't know them really, but being like, hey, I'm looking for a job. This is my specialty. specialty? Do you know anyone?
That's a perfect week, Ty. And I cannot tell you over the years, you and I could probably talk all day about different stories we had in our lives of that's where this job came from. That's where this idea came from. That what I think young adults need to understand is not just the strength of weak ties, but then they also have to have the courage to reach out to them and to realize that, you know, most people want to help you if they can, if they have something that you need, or if they know about something that would help you. Most people actually do want to help, especially younger people in life. So to have the courage to just put it out there, hey, this is what I'm looking for. Can anybody help?
Is the way that we prioritize work, finding this perfect career, climbing the ladder, is that helping us in the long run or hurting us? And maybe is it gender specific? Is it more beneficial to have that mindset as a man in your 20s than a woman, or vice versa?
Most people financially are going to need to work in some way. So I think it makes sense for men and women to both, you know, figure out what do I need to do to pay the bills and how is that going to work for me both in my 20s and over the long haul. I do sometimes hear too often, actually just got an email from this from someone about this the other day, is that they feel like they have to have career totally figured out before they can really think about dating or family. And I get it, you know, the wish for life to be linear and compartmentalized like that. But, you know, careers take a long time to sort. And so I said, I'm not really sure why these things can't go together in space and time. That I think we're, as an adult, as a 30-something, 40-something, 50-something, you have to figure out how are work and family going to fit in the same week, in the same day, in the same month. And so I think part of being a 20-something is not just figuring out, okay, how do I pay the bills, but also, what am I thinking about my future in terms of relationships and family? And maybe I need to start taking that more seriously too.
My millennial will be showing with this one, but I grew up glued to my radio listening to Dr. Drew on Loveline. That man raised me. Did anyone else listen to Loveline growing up? Okay, fast forward a few decades later, I'm listening to Dr. Peter McCullough bravely speak out against the vaccine mandates during the pandemic. One of my favorite companies that I've discovered recently is called The Wellness Company, and guess who makes up their chief medical board? None other than Dr. Peter McCullough and Dr. Drew Pinsky and other truth-telling doctors who are rooted in their commitment to building a parallel healthcare system and empowering you to take control of your health. In a post-COVID world, many Americans say, you know, I would avoid a doctor or hospital completely unless it was a catastrophic situation. And now the Wellness Company's medical emergency kit provides a solution. So this kit sits under my kitchen sink and it includes 8 life-saving medications, including amoxicillin, Z-Pak, and ivermectin for you to keep on hand along with a guidebook for safe use. From tick bites to COVID, UTIs, strep, extreme bioterror events, and more, virtually every scenario is covered with the medications included in this emergency kit so that in a dire emergency, another lockdown, or God forbid, we're all in hiding underground somewhere, you will be able to help a loved one in need or yourself immediately. And in less dire, more realistic events, I mean, well, I shouldn't say more realistic because the pandemic literally happened, but let's just talk about every day. I love this kit for families on the go, like my friends with tons of kids, for example, who almost always seem to have some sort of medical infection or problem right as they're packing their car to go on vacation. With the Wellness Company's medical emergency kit, they're able to deal with their issue immediately and then get back on the road without having to delay a vacation and wait for a doctor appointment. Don't wait until you need it. Take control of your health today with the Wellness Company's medical emergency kit. Go to twc.health/spillover with code spillover for 15% off and grab your medical emergency kit right now. You say that your 20s, not your 30s, are the time to start choosing your family. What does that mean?
Yeah, that actually, you know, kind of comes from that saying of, you know, well, you can't pick your family, but you can pick your friends. And that is true when you're growing up. But then suddenly you're in your 20s and it turns out, oh, gosh, I do pick my family. I'm about to pick my family. And I think that switch is new for people, obviously. And I remember when I was in graduate school, one of my first clients was a 20-something, and her dating life was a mess. And I have to admit, I don't think I was taking it very seriously because I'm really not sure that I knew how to do my job at that point. But my supervisor at the time said, you really need to help her, you know, think more about who she's going out with and how that's going. And I think I said something like, well, what difference does it make? It's not like she's going to marry him. And then she said, well, she might marry the next one. But besides, the best time to work on your marriage is before you have one. And that statement, you know, changed how I thought about 20-something relationships, but really how I thought about 20-somethings in general, that, you know, the best time to work on your career is before you have one. The best time to work on your marriage is before you have one. The best time to think about a prenup is before you need one. The best time to think about how many kids you want is before you're 35. And so a lot of my work with young adults has been helping them think about these big life decisions before they're actually making them.
The fertility conversation and a woman's fertile years have become a massive topic of discussion on Twitter. This is so heated because so many women feel like it's unfair to talk about having fertile years in a biological clock. But is it unfair? And why do you talk about this in your books?
Yeah, I think maybe people were a little surprised that I talk about that. I'm extremely candid about it in The Defining Decade. I think it's a very important conversation to have, not just with young women, but with young men too, to talk about what are you thinking about in terms of family? When are you thinking about having kids? Do you want to be a younger parent or an older parent? How old do you want to be when your kids graduate from college? Do you want to know your grandkids? So these are all questions you really do have to start asking yourself, you know, in your 20s, early 30s, for sure. I think people were surprised that I was asking those questions because I got my graduate degree from UC Berkeley, which everybody knows is a very liberal place. I'm a feminist, but I was certainly taught that feminists want families too. And I think it's actually very empowering to teach young women about their bodies and for them to educate themselves and young men as well about their choices and how those are going to impact themselves over time.
To me, it feels like the modern feminist movement wants to pretend like our biological clocks don't exist, and somehow that idea of thinking is more feminist. But I just feel like that's doing a disservice to women, because you have then what you're describing is these women that get into their mid-late 30s, then they think, oh, well, now it's time to start a family, because this is what I've been told, that 20s are for career and fun, and 30s, late 30s, early 40s, that's when you start a family. And then what you're seeing is this influx of young women who are now relying on, you know, IVF, surrogacy, all of these expensive fertility treatments that are not guaranteed to work or give you a child. And they feel like I was robbed. Why didn't anyone tell me this?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I don't have a horse in the race on whether or when people have kids, but I do have a horse in the race on educating young adults, giving them all the information that they could possibly have so that they can make decisions that they'll feel good about when they're in their 30s and 40s and 50s. Because another thing I think that we do culturally is that we act like managing to get pregnant is like the end. Like, okay, boom, did it. That's it. But then we have those kids and realize, shoot, I definitely want to be around another 30, 40 years. Like, I want to stick around for this. I'm not done. This is really the beginning. So yeah. I think we have to not just be thinking about what is the age at which I want to start a family, but what are the ages I want to be as my family grows.
Let's talk about love and heartbreak in your 20s.
Yes.
If you are in your 20s and you're in a serious, like, committed relationship, what are the best conversations to be having with your partner?
Well, in The Defining Decade, which was my first 20s something book, I have a new chapter because the updated edition came out in 2021. It's called 29 Conversations. I wish I could remember them all, Alex, but it's everything from, are you a religious person and do you want me to be a religious person, to what do you think about vacations? Is this something you spend a lot of money on or not a lot of money on? Do you want to have kids? When do you want to have kids? Do you want to be married or is that not your thing? That I think sometimes, you know, we feel like it's too soon to have those conversations, and then we don't have them and don't have them and don't have them. And then it kind of feels like it's too late because people feel like, well, shoot, I'm already with this person. Even if I don't like the answers, maybe I'll just stay.
Do you think that there is an epidemic of women willing to stay in relationships in their 20s for too long without moving towards engagement?
I think that both women and men get kind of caught into what we call lock-in, that, you know, it's sort of you move in together or you together every weekend, and then that's what you do. And there's this real fear of starting over, of what if there's not someone else out there? I don't want to go through this. I don't want to have to get a new place. I don't want to have to buy a new couch. And so, you know, both women and men who realize like this relationship is maybe not the one can drag on quite a bit longer than maybe it should have. I tell my clients, if there's a relationship you don't want to be in 5 years from now, you really have to ask yourself why you're in it now.
What you just brought up about how like some people, they're in this relationship for years and years and years in their 20s. And it's like the reason they stay in it is because one, they have a fear of what if there isn't anyone even better than this. So they're kind of settling. But also they're like, but it would be such a burden to try to figure out a new place to live. Who's going to get the TV? Who's going to get the couch? Who gets the dog? And so for that reason, do you feel like we should not be moving in with our significant other as quickly in our serious relationships in our 20s?
Yeah, I tell young adults, it's not whether you live with someone, it's how you do it. So the data show that people who decide to move in together thoughtfully, so usually that's after some period of time and they have a conversation of, hey, why are we doing this? Are we doing this for the same reasons? Do we have the same ideas about where we might be a year from now or 2 years from now? That those couples can do fine. It's the couples who, and the data show a lot of people do this, they move to get in together, you know, very early on. There's not really a conversation about it. It's more about convenience and fun. And then 6 months later or a year and a half later, when the relationship isn't going so great, their lives are intertwined. The person feels like, I don't have enough money to buy a new couch. I don't know where I'm going to find a new apartment. I don't want to have to start all over again. And then they end up staying with that person. No, I'm not suggesting they necessarily marry the person and, you know, go on to be miserable forever, as much as that relationship might drag on longer than it would have otherwise had they not been living together. So I tell clients to really be aware of the downsides of moving in with someone. The upsides are obvious. It's more convenient. You have permanent access to your friend and your lover and, you know, everything that goes with that. But the downsides can be is that we can get quite entangled and it can be harder to decide this isn't the right person than maybe we think.
Speaking of graduates or being in your 20s and moving out on your own, what better way to set up a young woman for success in her new space than gifting her a cute, non-toxic gift basket with items for her dorm or apartment? Alevia is my number one recommended non-toxic organic body skincare line. Alevia's non-toxic organic prebiotic body washes, hand washes, and lotions feed the skin's delicate microbiome to help repair quicker. Sensitive skin types that struggle with eczema, psoriasis, burns, scarring, or even keratosis pilaris, chicken skin, will love how accelerated that your skin's healing process is on this body wash without any harmful chemicals. That also means that this is a fantastic body wash and lotion for anti-aging concerns. Not that a college-age girl has those, but you might. She can put the hand wash in her kitchen and bathroom. We've got to start telling young women about eliminating harmful endocrine disruptors from her home. With less than 10 ingredients in each product, Alevia is the best of the best and has incredible natural and never artificial scents. Cranberry, lavender, green tea, honeysuckle, and citrus. Green tea honeysuckle is my absolute favorite one. I've never smelled anything like it anywhere else. Go to Alevia.com and use code ALEX15 for 15% off your order. That's Alevia.com with code ALEX15 for 15% off your order. Find the link in the description. Why is a broken heart a sign of health and not depression?
You're doing a really good job of moving across my two books, Alex. You've done this before. So yeah, I talk about that in my most recent book, The 20-Something Treatment. The number one precursor to feeling depressed in your 20s is big soccer, a breakup, that most 20-somethings are going to go through a difficult breakup in their young adult lives. And they often have a big impact on us, as they should. And so too often I have clients come into my office who are struggling after a breakup. They're crying all the time, don't want to get out of bed. They're not eating as much. Nothing seems as good. You know, they're pretty bummed out. They're pretty depressed. And they say, or they're told, that they have major depression. And then they feel like, great, you know, on top of not having a partner, now I have a mental health disorder. So I often reframe that and say, I don't think you're depressed. I think you're grieving. That if you really love someone, you really thought you were going to be with someone, and now you don't have that person in your life anymore, that's actually a healthy sign that you're sad about it. That means your attachment system is working. That means you let yourself love someone. You let yourself be sad that they're gone. We also know you're probably going to feel better. You know, in a few months, if even though it feels like you're never going to, we do know that you're probably going to get through this grieving process, and you're learning that this, unfortunately, probably not going to be the last person in your life that you lose in one way or another. So often those first breakups teach us, you know, not just about how to choose someone better for us next time, but also how to grieve, and we're going to grieve again.
It seems like it's becoming more abnormal to not be on antidepressants as a young adult. In your opinion, what is responsible for this uptick in prescriptions, and should that be concerning to us?
I am concerned about the prescriptions for young adults. I mean, it still is a minority. So I think about 25% of young adults are on a mental health med. That said, being on antidepressants are the number one most common prescription medication you will find in the medicine cabinet of any adult between the ages of 20 or 60. So they're very widely prescribed. It concerns me because I feel that oftentimes the conversations that are had with young adults before they go on antidepressants are too short. So something like 80% of the prescriptions for antidepressants are written by GPs, and no offense to GPs, but they often are sort of forced to work in these 15-minute appointments. So in a 15-minute appointment, you hear that someone is struggling and sad and not feeling great or feeling anxious or whatever the complaints are. And all you have time to do in that period is write a prescription for an antidepressant rather than find out from the person what's going on in your life, what might have caused these things. Is there anything we need to change or skills that you need to build? So oftentimes young adults go on antidepressants without much consideration of their situation, and they often aren't educated about the downsides.
Yeah.
Every mental health medication has side effects,
including anxiety and depression and suicidal thoughts.
Yes. You know, what I see most often with antidepressants are that, yes, they make people feel less bad. Sometimes, oftentimes they don't even accomplish that, but they often sometimes make people feel less good. So they, you know, sort of dampen all emotions, both the not so great ones and the great ones. So oftentimes 20-somethings don't like that when they discover that what's happened. You know, they can cause weight gain, sexual dysfunction, and then create a dependence in that when people try to go off of them, their brain doesn't like that. It can have a difficult reaction to people trying to wean themselves off their antidepressants. And so then they often panic and go, oh my gosh, I really need these. I've got to go back on. And so they can be harder to come off of, I think, than young adults are educated about. And that's something that I've tried to do in the 20-something treatment. I have a chapter called Why Medication is Not Always the Best Medicine. And it's not saying that it's never a good medicine, but it's not always the best medicine for young adults. That oftentimes we need to look at, what are the skills this person needs to be building? What is it about their situation that has become difficult? What are the changes they need to be making?
Am I crazy, or does it seem like way more young women than what I've seen in the past are saying that they have borderline personality disorder or they're bipolar?
That is a thing. I think we have social media to thank for that. So, you know, we used to call this 20 years ago, we called it medical student syndrome, when young medical students would, you know, start going through the textbooks and read about different physical or mental health disorders and go, oh my gosh, I have that. Well, now all that information is available online and in these, you know, short, interesting snippets on social media, which is, you know, both good and not good. The not good part of it is that we've got kind of medical student syndrome happening everywhere, where people hear about things and go, oh my gosh, I have that. So, you know, some of the symptoms of borderline personality disorder are unstable emotions, unstable relationships, unstable identity, unstable ways of coping, which for a lot of 20-somethings really sort of sums up their existence. I mean, that it's a very unstable time of life, and people are trying to sort out, how do I manage my emotions? How do I manage my relationships? You know, who am I going to be, and how am I going to cope? And, you know, just because you're still sorting that out, does not mean you have borderline personality disorder. As a matter of fact, I personally will not diagnose a personality disorder in someone under the age of 30, because I'm well aware of the fact that your personality changes more in your 20s than at any other time in life. So I don't think you can tell someone their personality is disordered when it hasn't even ordered itself completely yet.
I don't know anything about that. Our personality changes more than any other time in our life in our 20s?
Yeah. So because work is changing, love is changing, life is changing, and the brain is changing, it's going through its second big growth spurt. All those changes are happening at the same time. And so your personality is really still forming and shifting a lot in your 20s. So technically speaking, according to the DSM, you can diagnose a personality disorder in someone who's 18 or older. I will not do that because so much is changing in a 20-something that I think to tell them that their personality is disordered is premature. I'm actually in the business of preventing personality disorders, not in labeling young adults with them for life.
When I would take personality tests in my teens and early 20s, I always got like extremely extroverted type of personality, ENFJ, whatever. Now I'm 31. And when I take these tests and also just assessing myself and being self-reflective, I definitely feel like I am way more introverted than I was when I think back to being in high school and then in my early 20s. So could that be part of my personality shifting, that now I'm a little bit more settled and I am more introverted than I used to be?
Absolutely. I mean, especially the settled part. I mean, you know, for anyone out there listening who's out of their 20s, I mean, look back on your 20s. I mean, I think we all remember being way more volatile and way more anxious and way more stressed and depressed and way more unsettled. That's what happens in the brain when it's dealing with so much uncertainty. And that is normal. That we know that mental health gets better when life gets better. We settle down on the inside when life settles down on the outside. And so it's very common for young adults to feel emotionally unsettled. That does not mean that they have mental health disorder. I mean, I think the thing to really understand is that it is very easy for a 20-something to meet criteria for mental health disorder, which is a problem of the DSM, that they it does not take age into account at all. So someone is correct in saying, well, I meet all the criteria. And I'm thinking, well, I know you do, but that's because the criteria really aren't great and they're not taking your developmental context into account at all. And I'm not sure, and I'm actually thinking you probably won't meet all these criteria 5 years from now or 10 years from now. So let's not go labeling yourself for life with something, especially something like a personality disorder.
So at what age are you settled with your personality? Like, okay, what your personality is at this age, this is probably what you're going to be for the rest of your life.
Well, of course, that's a question that doesn't have a cliff attached to it. But, you know, most of the data says around 30 is when, you know, after that, people might change some based on life circumstances, but that generally you've settled down. And this is probably what your adult self is going to look like, partly because, you know, our brains have stopped the second growth spurt. We've kind of settled into certain ways of living, habits, careers, et cetera. And so that those tend to kind of stay somewhat consistent. I mean, we may change some if we have a big change in our life circumstances, but we're not going to change drastically.
So what I'm hearing, Dr. J, is that the fact that I am still a diehard Taylor Swift fan at 31, my audience needs to get over it. I'm not changing. This is who I am.
It's a done deal. Yeah.
Team hair down there or no hair? It's really your prerogative. There's not a right or wrong answer. There is, however, a right and wrong answer when it comes to what type of feminine products you're using. I get all of my pads, tampons, and panty liners from Garnu. Garnu is the cutest period product company that is conservative owned and completely non-toxic and uses only 100% organic cotton. I am obsessed with this company. They ship right to my door monthly, in sync with my cycle, so I'm never in a panic checking every old person's suitcase in my closet for a tampon until I can make it to the store the next day. By the way, No, there is not one singular experience in this world that you have had and no one else has had. Yes, I have dug through my suitcases last minute looking for one rogue tampon. Not only is Garnu's packaging better than anything you're going to find at the drugstore, like, it's just so cute. Their values are too. You won't be supporting a company who calls women bleeders or funds abortion. Garnu shares your values, and instead of funding the murder of the unborn, they donate proceeds from each purchase to fight human trafficking in Nepal. Garnu actually means rescue in Nepali. I'm telling you, there is not a cooler period company. And these are items that you have to buy every month already. So stop giving your money to people that hate you. Fund the parallel economy with me by getting your period products from Garnu. They've got period cups also, and also my favorite merch. Dead serious, their hoodies are everything. Go to Garnu.com today and use code Alex for 15% off. Garnu.com with code Alex for 15% off. Find the link in the show notes and have a happy strawberry week. What is going on with sex and young adults in America? Because I feel like the data shows that we're having less sex in our 20s, but that we're supplementing it with pornography. Is that true? And if it is, how is that affecting brain development?
It is somewhat true. So the data show, and you know, my clients say 20-somethings are having less sex than they were having 20, 30 years ago. Some people say it has a bit to do with the rise in porn and watching porn, especially among young males. I wouldn't entirely disagree with that. Some people say it has to do with young adults drinking less than, you know, in decades past. And I see that as well, that I do think young adults are sort of less likely to kind of drink heavily and hook up. So I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing.
Well, I think they're all smoking weed instead of drinking. That's what, I mean, am I wrong? I just feel like it's more popular. Everybody's just high.
Well, yeah, I mean, to a certain extent. But, you know, I see more young adults saying, I want to have sex, but I haven't had it yet. I'm feeling anxious about it. I'm feeling stressed about it. I don't know how to dip my toe into it. And you definitely see this among young males who watch a lot of porn, that this is very common. It's actually a common intake question. When I have a new client, I say, hey, we're about to get real familiar, but how much porn are you watching? And so you would be surprised.
Tell us.
A lot. So it's very common, especially for young males, to say, I'm watching a lot. And for them to say, I'm watching more than I want to be.
But what is a lot to them? Is that daily? Is it multiple times a day, multiple times a week?
I have seen that, all three of those, as problematic for different males. I have had, you know, at the far end of the spectrum, someone saying, yeah, more than once a day, I'm in a bad way. This is way too much. I've also had males say, I watch it a couple times a week, and that's too much for me. I don't even want to be doing that. I do. Oftentimes males will say, oh, yeah, I watch it sometimes, but I don't think it's a problem. And I believe them that that's, you know, they're not experiencing any problems for it. But when you have males who are saying, I'm doing it multiple times a week, certainly every day or multiple times a day, they are also usually saying, it's a problem. I don't like it. I want to stop. And that it's gotten in the way of me being able to, you know, be attracted to women in person or be able to perform with women in person, and that that's causing me a lot of stress and anxiety too.
Are you seeing a rise in erectile dysfunction in men in their 20s?
I have seen some of that in my practice, but the data is definitely reporting that worldwide, that along with the rise in watching porn, we've seen a rise in erectile dysfunction and also the use of erectile dysfunction meds in young adults because they think, oh no, I'm feeling anxious about having sex, maybe because I've been watching sex and watching porn instead of figuring out how to do that myself. So I go out there and I try to be sexually active. I'm feeling stressed. I'm being anxious. I have a hard time performing. So if I just had a pill, that would fix everything. I think there's also a misconception around young men that they feel like they need to perform like they're seeing in porn videos without asking their partner, is that really what you want? And so feeling anxious about that has also led some males to say, you know, maybe a little erectile dysfunction medication could assist me with that.
I've had multiple young women message me and say things like, I had a first date, and as he was kissing me goodbye, he put his hand around my neck. And when I asked him why he was doing that, he said, well, I thought that you would like it. Lots of like really strange, aggressive sexual behavior, not even just outside of the bedroom, that I feel like a lot of young women are experiencing, and they feel like they're attributing it to porn, that these guys are being trained on on how to interact with women, they think that they're being romantic and that this is what girls want because it's what is in porn, but it's not the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think we really need to be having a regular conversation with our kids or with high school students, with college students about that. Probably the best comparison that I've heard, and I don't remember what it was, a radio program I was listening to, but they said something like learning how to have sex from a porn video is like learning how to drive by watching Fast and Furious movies. Like, this is not how you do it. And so just to help young adults understand both the dangers of watching porn in a way that it can get, interfere with your being able to have a healthy sexual relationship with another person, but also that what you're seeing, these are not healthy sexual scripts or not what most people want in a relationship.
Yeah. So to transition out of sex, but something else that everybody does and wants to do and needs to do to survive is eating. And I love that you focused on, we have to be teaching young people how to cook, why this is so important. And I was like, thank you. Finally, Dr. J gets it, because we took home ec out of schools. This is a huge problem, and I think a lot of this contributes to so many areas, but I want to hear it from you. Why was it important for you in your books to include, we have to be talking to young people about cooking?
Yeah, a lot of people are surprised that in the 20-something treatment, I have a chapter called How to Cook. None of my recipes are included, but it's just more about the importance of learning how to cook when you're a teenager or in college or in your 20s. And, one reason for that is 20-somethings are very overwhelmed by sort of all these big projects. They're trying to figure out careers, they're trying to figure out love, they're trying to figure out family, that, these are all long form projects where they're putting the work in. They're not going to see the results. And they, they kind of want instructions or directions. And that's not available for most, adult projects. But the good news is that's absolutely available every single day if you cook, that we have recipes, we have instructions, you can do something and you can see the results. It can be very satisfying. We also know that the majority of young adults call themselves unhealthy eaters, that they don't know how to feed themselves or cook in a way to feed themselves properly. So when people cook, they tend to eat more healthily, and that's good for your body and for your brain. So I encourage young adults to learn how to cook because it helps you feel like you can solve some of life's problems. I mean, if you're trying to get through your day and three times a day, something you need to do to stay alive is something that you can't even figure out how to do or that you can't feel success around, that doesn't really help when you're already feeling overwhelmed about work and love and life and everything else.
If you're cooking at home, the quality of your food is going to be better. It's not going to be filled with a bunch of processed preservatives, seed oils, all these other issues, which I've talked a lot about on my show in other episodes with other people. But also, the amount of money when you eat out every meal or you're DoorDashing or Uber Eats every meal.
It's so much.
It is unbelievably expensive. Right. Unbelievably expensive. I just talked about on my YouTube channel a few days ago or a few weeks ago. This girl shows she got a milkshake, fries, and two things of chicken nuggets at Chick-fil-A. It cost her $40.
Wow,
and if you're doing that every meal, you're going to go broke. So we've got to get back to getting in the kitchen.
Well, that's, when you said my financial advice, I said no credit card debt. That would be some of it, too, of stop all the eating out and the door dashing and the Uber Eats. Because, most young adults, or really adults of any age, cannot afford to eat that way financially, but they can't afford to eat that way nutritionally. We also know that eating a lot of processed, high sugar, high fat foods, it's actually not great for your mental health, that the gut is what's called the second brain. It's second only to the brain in terms of the number of neurons it contains. So what you're eating has an impact on your mental health, on how you're feeling every day. So people who cook more tend to eat more healthily. It's also better for your social life because you have more confidence around, let me have people over and we can have a potluck or, make a meal, or I'll bring someone a birthday cake, that it helps people with some of that socializing that people are saying they want to be doing more of.
That's a really good point. I love that idea. If you know how to cook or bake, you can show up for a friend or even, an acquaintance and become a friend by showing up for them in that way and bringing them something. And I also like you bringing up the gut-brain connection and how what we eat can affect our mental health, because just like you mentioned, those 10 or 15 minute checkups with your general practitioner, which is when they're prescribing likely these antidepressants, they're not sitting there asking you about your diet. They're not.
No.
They're not asking any of these young people about their diet and what they're eating and how that could be affecting their mental health. One, because they don't have the time, but two, because they only have days worth of nutritional training and all of their years of medical school. We're not even training our regular typical primary doctors on the nutrition aspect. So that's such a good point. I love that you brought all that up. I know for me, Dr. J, when I was in my early 20s, I had immense anxiety about which jobs I should take, which jobs I should say no to, which cities would be good for me to move to. It felt crippling. I felt like, okay, what if I make the wrong choice and it's going to ruin my entire life because I took the wrong job or said no to the right one. So what is your advice for people in their 20s that are struggling on how do I know if I'm making the right life decisions?
Yeah. So the thing about adult decisions are what are called large world problems. Large world problems, they don't have right answers. They don't have wrong answers. They only have your answers. So, you know, part of your 20s are spent figuring out what's right or wrong for you. So the only way to know that is to try this field or try to date this kind of person, see what information that you learn from that. And then based on that, you know, okay, well, now I do more of that or I do less of that and I go this way. So it's actually, I think it can be stressful. A lot of young adults, they want the answer. They want to know the algorithm. They want to know the formula. Doesn't exist. But it can be freeing when we realize that there isn't a right answer. There isn't a wrong answer. There's just your answer. So you really have to make that based on your values, your goals, your experiences, and you know what feels right for you.
Tell us about your two books that cover all of your advice for being in your 20s and the differences between those books and where people can get them.
Yeah, so the first was The Defining Decade, Why Your 20s Matter and How to Make the Most of Them Now. And they're really about why your 20s are so defining, the most defining years of your life. And then the second is The 20-Something Treatment, The Revolutionary Remedy for an Uncertain Age. What's revolutionary about it is that it's an age specific approach to mental health that emphasizes skills over pills. And they should be available everywhere or somebody's in trouble. So they're available everywhere. Or you can find me on Instagram at Dr. Meg J or on my website, MegJ.com.
Thank you, Dr. J, for coming on The Spillover.
That was fun, Alex. Yeah, thanks for having me.
I thought that this time of the year was just going to be the perfect time for this interview to come out because it's graduation season. Dr. J's books are perfect for yourself if you're in your 20s or a friend or a loved one graduating high school or college. And here's some more exciting news. We've teamed up with Dr. Meg J to bring you an exclusive giveaway of her new book, The 20-Something Treatment, A Revolutionary Remedy for an Uncertain Age. So whether you're struggling to find your footing, you're searching for love, or you're facing the daunting task of building your future, Dr. Meg J offers expert insight to mental health strategies for 20-somethings during the defining decade. And here's the best part. We're giving away a free audiobook copy of The 20-Something Treatment to one listener of The Spillover. For a chance to win, head over to Instagram, follow Dr. J at Dr. Meg J to learn more about it. If you enjoyed this episode and you want to go in depth on these topics even more, you're going to love my episode from March of this year with Suzanne Venker on how to build a better life. Suzanne, by the way, one of our main stage speakers at YWLS. Don't forget to get your tickets in the show notes. Next week's episode comes out Thursday night anywhere you get your podcasts at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. I'm Alex Clark, and this is The Spillover. Love you, mean it. Bye.